dead, and behold, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. And those same women encountered Jesus just a little while later. And Matthew tells us that Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me." Now, Galilee was the northern provinces that was about 90 miles north of Jerusalem. And so the apostles obediently went off on this 90-mile journey. It was a walk. It was a walk of several days to get to some disclosed place where Jesus would meet them. And we read in Matthew chapter 28 that the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had designated. And there they saw him, and they worshipped him, but some were doubtful. And there on that high hill, that so-called mountain in Galilee, Jesus gave these words to his apostles, words which, according to Matthew, were his parting words, his final words. "All authority," Jesus said, "has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." Now these were, according to Matthew, the concluding words of Jesus' ministry. Shortly after this, he ascended to heaven. They saw him disappear from the earth, and he disappeared out of their sight and went, as he had said, to sit at the right hand of God, from which he would rule over the world. And these words describe that rule. He says, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." We want to look at these words today because we're considering the difference that Jesus makes in the life of a person who recognizes that he's alive and that he is Lord and trusts himself or herself to Jesus. These are words which help us to get some glimpse of the contrast between the life before you entrust yourself to Christ and the life that awaits you once you do. The difference that he makes to a person who sees him as a way to God, who sees him as a bridge, and walks across that bridge into a relationship with God. And I'd like us to look at the words of verses 18 and 19, 20 in reverse order to see three things that are true of a person who entrusts himself to Christ, who finds Jesus to be the bridge and walks across the bridge, which is to say, commits his life to Jesus and enters into a relationship with God through him. We could say it this way, and if you've noticed the sermon outline in the back of your bulletin, you can fill in some blanks and keep track of where we're going with this. We've seen over the last couple of weeks that Jesus is a bridge good enough to get us to God. In fact, the perfectly good bridge to God and the bridge to life in God. What we want to see today is that Jesus, the perfectly good bridge to life, offers all who entrust themselves to him three things. In the first place, an escape from helplessness. We ought not to think about the fact that we ought not to think about our position uncommitted to Christ as being in a pretty good place, but we could upgrade. That's certainly true. We've already talked about trading sorrow and pain and sickness and all the dangers of life lived by yourself for the security and the comfort of living with God. But we ought not to think of ourselves presently as in a pretty good place that could benefit from an upgrade. We need to see ourselves in a position of peril. We need to understand that the ground we're standing on, so to speak, as we look across the chasm that Jesus bridges, is sinking ground, is sand or ground that's soon to fall apart. We are people in danger. And Jesus offers us help. We see it in the very concluding words of the statement. He says, and this is the very last phrase, according to Matthew, that they heard him speak, "And lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age." Lo is a bit of a question. There's no actual word in English that completely translates until you get into Old English, like lo. You can think about lo like behold, lo and behold. Think about lo and add an okay to it, and it's the word look. That's got nothing to do with the origin of the word, but it helps to understand what he's saying. He's saying, hey, look, look here. I am with you always, even to the end of the age. What he says to people who entrust themselves to him is, you will never be alone. I will always be with you. You'll always have me. You'll always have help. This is to have a great source of help always present. And although there are times when we feel practically invulnerable, we in actual fact are people who are very vulnerable and very much in need of help. I learned the word invulnerable when I was a kid reading Superman comics. Invulnerable was one of the things that Superman was. But even with Superman, it was a bit of an illusion. because he was only invulnerable and unable to be hurt as long as no one showed up with some green kryptonite. And as soon as Lex Luthor found the kryptonite and flashed it in front of Superman, his vulnerability just disintegrated. And there are times when we feel invulnerable. There are times when we draw the doubtful conclusion that since nothing very bad has happened to us yet, it probably is true that nothing ever bad will happen to us. That's a very doubtful conclusion. You know, we have a number of differences between us. We come from different backgrounds and different perspectives on life. We're different ages. But here's one thing we all have in common. None of us have died yet. So we could look around and say, you see, in actual fact, we're the ones who don't do that. We never will. We'll never be, you know, dead. But that's clearly not true. And the way which we get from having never died to dead is fraught with peril. Obviously, the kind of stuff that could kill you. That's what we're talking about. Feeling invulnerable is an optical illusion. And there's a lot of green kryptonite around, things that could bring our vulnerability into our awareness. Life is full of danger. We drive cars, you know, these great big 2,000-pound masses of glass and metal. And people get hurt in those cars. Anybody who's driven at all has a story of a near miss. Isn't it almost a commonplace? You come home, hi, how are you? Fine. You'll never guess what happened. I just about got creamed. I mean, that happens all the time, right? And sometimes we don't escape. Sometimes people get very badly hurt. Sometimes people get killed just driving around. And then there's sickness, and we're healthy as long as we're not sick, and then we get sick, and sometimes it's a complete surprise. I never thought this would happen. I deal with people who, encountering sickness, are sometimes able to take it in stride because they understood that this could happen, and now it's happened. But other people act completely shocked, as if they thought that they would never get sick and never get old and never die. In actual fact, people are sick, getting sick, and dying of sickness all the time. There's all kinds of diseases out there that we know about and we dread, and others that we only discover when the doctor explains to us that this is one that we have. We are vulnerable people. Our livelihood, our well-being, our survival depends upon our bodies withstanding all of the diseases, all the viruses, all the infections that they are prone to. And just because we've so far got this far doesn't mean that we're not going to be struck down by some sickness soon. And not to be overly cynical or pessimistic, but you realize some of us could be carrying around in our bodies the beginning of some mortal illness, and we haven't detected it, but if we'd gone to enough specialists, they could probably see that it's in there somewhere, and eventually it'll catch up to us, so we'll be dying of some kind of sickness. And then there's crime. There's people who, you know, people whose homes are broken into, and they're shot, and they're attacked, and they're wounded, and they're murdered. And it's not just us that we have to worry about. It's us and every person we love. So you could live a long time and never get sick and never get in a car accident and never get victimized by a criminal, but you've got all your loved ones to worry about as well. And for that matter, there's all sorts of people besides the ones you love that you should worry about, because we're all together on this planet. And there are just so many things that could be going wrong right now that could go wrong. You realize the tons and tons of biological weapons and germ warfare that's gone missing since the Iron Curtain fell. Russia had stockpiled tons and tons of military weaponry that's just gone now. And where is it? Probably in the hands of some terrorist camp that's deciding what to do with it. What do they know about London, Ontario? What are the prospects of us being the victims of a kind of a mass destruction that we have seen going on around the world up until now? And there's so many other things that could go wrong. There's irregularities in the weather, right? There's the disturbing possibility of the polar ice caps melting, and your house will get flooded, and all your continent will get flooded. And, I mean, we could die so many different ways. There's the dangers of genetically altered vegetables, which is a danger I don't really understand, but it's out there, you know, and somebody should be carrying a placard about that, too. We are in such peril. You realize that our economy nationally is pretty much totally tied into the economy of the United States. And you realize that our country and the United States have this in common. We're deeply, deeply in debt. And what's more exciting, the American economy is pretty dependent upon oil from Saudi Arabia. And actually, Saudi Arabia is where all the terrorists come from. So the likelihood that we're going to go on living without any need of outside help for a long, long time. And then, you know, when we've lived a long, full life and we don't have any aches or pains, one day while we're, you know, dozing around in the morning, snooze button, snooze button, we just decide that we've had a long enough and a happy enough life, and so we just give up the ghost and die without any pain. The chance of that happening is really pretty small. We are people who are actually pretty vulnerable, and we need help. We need help in a big way. And here are the words of Jesus to those who have entrusted themselves to him. Lo, lo and behold. As if he said, hey, look, I will be with you always. That's an important thing to know, that we can face all the dangers of getting sick, of getting killed in traffic, of getting struck down by a criminal, or getting caught up in some global destruction. We can entrust all of that to the Lord and just let him help us in whatever ways we need help. That's one of the ways in which Jesus makes a difference. One of the differences that's experienced by a person who sees Jesus as the way to God, as a bridge to God, and entrusts himself to Christ, who walks the bridge to life in God. But that's not all. Let me tell you something about you. You are meant to live a life that really means something. Sometimes you feel that and sometimes you forget that, but it's true all the time. You are created to live a life that really means something. And in these closing words of Jesus, he offers us, in addition to an escape from helplessness, an escape from pointlessness. You can write that down. An escape from pointlessness. We, being what we are, we're meant to live a life that really means something, that really adds up to something, that really accomplishes something. We are people who need a mission in life. And it needs to be a big mission which coordinates all the things that we really care about. A mission so big that every worthwhile thing we're engaged in can be fitted into it and thematically lined up with what we're for. And what Jesus was giving his apostles with the clear instruction that they would pass on this assignment to others was a mission in life which would give a point to their lives and an escape from pointlessness. What Jesus came to give is really good news. And this is really good news when you consider how hungry we are to live lives that mean something meaningful. There's some blanks to fill in. It's really good news when you consider how hungry we are to live lives that mean something meaningful. We can go a long time. We can go 10 years, 20 years without it really thinking about the big purpose of life. But there are some of us who are more sensitive to pointlessness than others, and there are times in our life when we're more painfully aware of the fact that we're living our lives, it's going by, and it's not really adding up to very much. But Jesus gives his followers this assignment. He says, go therefore and make disciples of all the nations. And he explains how to do that. He says, bring them into a relationship with me. That's what baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit means. And then he says, and get them up and running on the same assignment. He says, teach them all the things that I commanded you. He's giving us here a life assignment, recognizing that there is no real life until you entrust yourself to Christ, but there's real life when you do that. He says, why not devote your life to helping other people cross the bridge? Why not live your life helping people get to be the sort of people who can help other people to cross the bridge that Jesus is to life? This is a mission. This is a purpose that would help us to make sense of all of our lives and help us to bring meaning to everything that we care about, everything that we should care about at least. Picture a man, say, like me. A man, say, my age. Got a few things on my mind, you know. I've got kids that I want to see grow up to become worthwhile human beings. I'm raising kids, still kind of doing that all these years later. And I've got a life to keep up. I've got a job to keep. It's kind of a life mission. It's a work to build. If I was in the business world, I would just say I got a business to build, or I got a career to keep track of. But business and career sounds a little funny when I'm talking about what I do. But you know, I got my family, I got my household projects, I got my kids to raise, I got my work, And then I got a few things I like doing. I got some hobbies. And then I've got a few talents. And I could kind of float from one to another, bounce from one to another, do a little this, little that, little that. But if I commit myself to Christ and take upon myself the assignment to make disciples, to see the world, as much as I'm in control of any part of the world, come to recognize the Lordship of Christ, then each component part of my life, each thing I do that I care about, can be made to fit this one assignment, right? I can raise my kids not just to be worthwhile human beings who basically stay out of jail, but I could fit that assignment in under this commission and do what I can to encourage them and train them and urge them to be disciples of Christ and find that as a purpose for living. And I could build my business, whatever work I'm in, so that it fits in with the purpose. Think about a man in the business world. He could just be doing his business. He could be working his career for the salary or for the wealth, but he could do it for the Lord. He could do it to let there be at least one place in the business community where you could, you know, work an honest day's work and be well paid for it and prioritize your life. He could, you know, take care of that part of civilization by looking after that part of the business community. And he could work to make a profit so that he'd have the ability to fund this kind of work, to support missionaries who go off into the world and make disciples of all the nations. And then, you know, you've got your pastimes, you've got your hobbies, it's tennis or something. Well, you could take your mission in life to the tennis court and look for an opportunity to, you know, to play tennis in a way that shows people what sport should be like instead of what it gets to be like. And you could use your sporting interest to meet people and to explain to them as much as they let you explain of what it means to be a disciple of Christ. And, you know, if you've got your talents, you sketch with a pencil or you play guitar or you write poetry or write songs or something like that. You could fit that under the big purpose as well. You could be like Johann Sebastian Bach, who did all of his composing for the glory of God alone. He wrote little initials at the bottom of the scores. To the glory of God alone was his motto. And he took his artistic abilities, he took his hobby, he took his great love of life, his talent, and he channeled it to that. And so life can become thematically one. It can be to a purpose. And as time goes by, you can escape that sense that life is slipping away and it's not adding up to much. And you can even absorb the impact of a particular assignment not going very well, raising your kids or building your business or developing your talent. Maybe you get to a dead end with some of those things, but you can fit it in under this big umbrella of a real reason for living. And say, my life has a point to it. My life has a purpose. And we, as we get to know ourselves, are hungry to live lives that mean something, that add up to something, however long they last. And this offer of Jesus, this commission that he's given to his followers in all places and in all time, gives us an opportunity to escape from the appalling possibility of living a meaningless life, a pointless life. This is good news for people who understand how hungry we all are to live lives that mean something meaningful. But that's not all. And if we finish with what he started with and go to what he said in the first place in verse 18, we'll see here that Jesus, the perfectly good bridge to life, offers all who entrust themselves to him an escape from hopelessness. An escape from hopelessness. To be joined to Christ in a faith commitment, to be personally rescued by him so that he's your bridge, is the ultimate example of having a friend in high places. When you take what Jesus did and own it, when you recognize his death on the cross to be a death that he died for you and the forgiveness for sins that he made available, the forgiveness of your sins, when you get that tightly connected to Christ, that he is your Lord, that he is your Savior, then you have got the ultimate friend in high places. For there's nothing he can't fix. There's nothing he can't solve. There's no question he can't answer. For the simple reason that he, being God, is the one in charge of everything. And this is what he meant when he said, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." He made that perfectly plain by the life he lived, and by the words he spoke, and by his very being. Over and over again, Matthew and Mark and Luke and John show that Jesus was the one in charge, the one in control of everything, so that, you know, when food ran out, he could take a little bit of food and feed a multitude. He did that twice. And when the wine ran out, he could take water and command it to become wine. He was totally in control of food. He was totally in control of liquid to drink. He was in control of all liquids. When his disciples were caught in a storm that made them fear for their lives out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, he walked to them across the water. And he showed himself to be totally in control of the elements and the weather by getting into the boat and then rebuking the wind and the waves, and the whole lake the storm just disappeared and the lake became like glass. He showed over and over again that he was totally in control of the natural world. And he not only rebuked bad weather, but he rebuked demons, and so showed himself to be in total authority of the spiritual world. And he rebuked sickness, and he healed people at a word, paralyzed people and deaf people and blind people and people who had internal hemorrhaging. He could just touch them. He could just say the word. Even from a distance, he could command the sickness to be gone, and showed himself totally in control of all these problems that people might have. And he was in control of people. The townspeople, sensing the insult of him coming not just to the Jews but to the Gentiles as well, rushed him to the edge of a cliff to push him over. This, by the way, was normally the way a stoning would start. You throw the victim of the execution off the cliff, and if the fall doesn't kill him, then you pile stones on him. They were about to stone him, is what that was. But he just turned and looked at them, and no one dared contradict him as he walked through the crowd. He was totally in control. When he stood before Pilate, and Pilate said, "Don't you realize I have the authority to command your death?" He said, in a matter-of-fact way, "You wouldn't have any authority except that it was given to you from above." He was in control of all things in heaven and on earth. And he was the authority over death, so that he was able to raise dead people back to life, whether they had just died, like the widow's son, or whether the person had been dead for days and had started to decompose, like Lazarus, who was in the tomb for 4 days. And when he himself died, he showed his power over death by coming to life from his own death, raising himself back to life. So that he says at one particular point to one particular follower, "Do not fear. I am the beginning of all things, and I am the end of all things, and I have the keys of death and of hell." So that when our ultimate problem faces us and we have no hope of surviving life in this world and death in this world, Jesus, our friend, says, "Don't worry about a thing. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. I have authority over life and all matters of life, and authority over death and all issues of death. I have the keys of death. You're safe with me." So we are people in need of help. And we are people who need a hope. And Jesus is that hope, which is really good news when you think of how quickly the years of our lives are racing by. Now, sometimes, at some stages in our life, we're not very aware of that. We see the years stretching out over the horizon of our imagination, and it seems to us like life is going to go on forever. But we know that's not true, right? And there are other times and stages of life when we're painfully aware of the fact that we can't go on like this for much longer, especially if we think about how quickly time goes by, how quickly a year goes by. I mean, we just had another Easter. We're hardly recovered from the previous Christmas, and it's Easter. Now Easter's gone, and here comes the summer. And a year goes by so quickly, as it becomes a smaller and smaller increment of the whole, the years just seem less and less significant, right? When you're a kid, Christmas would never come. Now, as an adult, Christmas just don't stop coming. Life goes on. And a decade is not all that long a period of time. And have you ever stopped to really think about how many decades you possibly have a hope of being left to you? I mean, if you're kind of pushing 50, how many decades left are there? Maybe 3. Although by the time I've done 3 more decades, I may not be counting very well. 4 decades, maybe, but me at 90, I don't know. There's just not that much time left, whoever you are. And that's if nothing bad happens, right? I mean, we are people who are who are living lives balancing on the head of a pin. We're living lives that dangle by a thread. And we need some solid ground to live on, to stand on. We need a hope. So it's really good news that Jesus, who offers to take us across the chasm to God, is totally in control of all things, is the authority over all things in heaven and on earth. And we can entrust ourselves to him. And as we do, things change. As we do, that hope and that joy and that help that we've been considering in song and in word today begins to become the meaning of our lives and the solidity of our lives. It becomes a solid ground upon which we stand, ready and able to face whatever the future holds, not even needing to be very concerned about what the future holds, because we know who holds us, and he's in control of all things. And over the last couple of weeks, we've had opportunity to hear a few people stand on the bridge, so to speak, and talk about the transition that has occurred in their lives, the transformation that has occurred in their lives as they've entrusted themselves to Christ. And I'm glad that you have an opportunity to hear from a couple more like that today.
Good morning. My name is Chuck Stover. I'm thankful for the opportunity to share some of the experiences that 20 years ago, at age 40, brought me into God's kingdom across the bridge of faith in Christ. I grew up in South America, where my father worked for an American oil company. And by the time I came to Canada for high school, I'd never been exposed to the true saving gospel of Christ. After high school, and then 5 more years at the University of Toronto to become a dentist, I still had no idea of my need to be born again, or that God through Christ saves sinners. In looking back at the events of my life through my 20s and 30s, I can see how God used those circumstances to prepare me for the day he would reveal that I was not the righteous dentist I had imagined, but rather a sinner in need of being rescued from my own spiritual self-destruction. Some of the events that began to break down my independent and self-sufficient nature were a divorce after 7 years and the responsibilities of raising 2 children from public school through college. Social drinking and the game of golf was my way of coping with the stress of dentistry and single parenting. Sadly, the all-consuming perfection of my golf swing became my motto, a day without golf is a day lost. During that whole time, I can't say I ever consciously sought God. I had a sense there must be more to life, but I had no idea where to find it. Towards the end of my 30s, something changed. I began to tire of and question my lifestyle. This dissatisfaction, along with recurring thoughts about God, led me to begin reading some books on philosophy and even taking a course on religion at Western. None of this brought any real satisfaction. I became disillusioned with my life and my friends, who never seemed to question their purpose in life. At some point, I decided to quit the weekend drinking and partying with friends. This left me so bored on Sundays, I began to watch a TV preacher who talked about sin and the blood of Christ. When he was talking about my sin, I would become so convicted, I immediately turned him off. After months of this, there was still no permanent change in my life. The next event to occur did result in change. For a week, it was as if a deep, dark cloud of depression came over me. I experienced a complete loss of focus, direction, and purpose. I became confused and vulnerable as I watched all my self-confidence disappearing. This was so disturbing that by Friday night, I only wanted to be alone. That night, I found myself becoming overwhelmed with guilt and shame as I felt the weight of my sin. For the first time in my life, I was seeing how offensive my sins were to a holy and righteous God. I knew I deserved his judgment, and I was powerless to stop these convicting thoughts. All this resulted in me finally admitting to God that I was a sinner, living independent of him. With this confession, a huge weight lifted from my chest. The fear and dread of a holy God was immediately replaced by a sense of peace and forgiveness. Not having read the Bible, I did not understand this experience. All I knew was that my perspective on God and life had changed. The confusion, anger, and frustration were gone, replaced with a hatred for my sin and a love for God and others that I had never had. It would be many months before I attended a church. At that time, I thought church was only a place for hypocrites. As God would have it, I ended up hiring Lillian, now my wife, as my dental assistant. Through her constant and faithful witness, and God convicting me to stop playing golf on Sundays, I gave in and attended West London Alliance. Coming under the preaching of God's word brought the conviction that an intense study of the Bible was necessary to discover the true character and will of God. As much as it was devastating at the time, I became very grateful to God for spiritually awakening my soul. The search for life's true meaning and purpose was over. By His sovereign grace, I had found the pearl of great price. I was no longer a fugitive running from God. God, having settled this personal relationship, has revealed who I am in Christ and where my home really is. His truth had set me free. Through years of Bible study, it has become very clear that 2,000 years ago, Christ fully accomplished my salvation. By dying on His cross to bear the penalty I deserved, I now recognize God's sovereign authority over my life. Because He created me, He owns me. My responsibility now is to trust in His plans and purposes for my life and for His world. Thank you.
I've wanted to do this for 3 weeks. In regard to God and a right relationship with God, I can say now that I grew up in a state of considerable confusion. Grew up in a really happy home, a church-going home, and I could tell by the serious way that my parents took their church-going that it was all good and right and important. But I think now I know part of why I was in a state of confusion. I used to watch my father sitting in church as I sat beside him, and he tells me all these years later that when I was a kid and he was a young man with his family in church, he was in a considerable kind of frustration. He said, you know, it just became more and more apparent to me that I just don't get it. I would sit in church week after week and wonder what they were talking about, really, what it all meant. So maybe the confusion is an inheritable thing. My confusion showed up in the teenage equivalent of bedtime prayers. I've been taught as a child to pray before I went to bed, and I kept up the habit when I was a teenager going to bed on my own. I would lie in bed and kind of stare up at the ceiling and pray. And I heard myself praying my confusion. I would sometimes pray about being a Christian. I would say, Lord, help me to be a better Christian. But I didn't really like the sound of that prayer, so I sometimes changed it and said, Lord, help me to be worthy of the name Christian. And I wasn't sure what all that meant, so I sometimes prayed, Lord, help me to understand what it means to be a Christian. And I lived in a state of confusion like that for some years. And then, happily, a really smart person moved to my hometown and settled into the church that my parents were taking us to, and he started a lecture series on Tuesday nights at the midweek adult prayer meeting that my parents attended. And he began teaching the Bible with a sense of its authority. His big point was that the Bible was far more true than most of us were reckoning it to be. And my parents would tell me week by week what this really, really smart man said. And I listened with interest, because I had a sense that I had a distance to overcome. I had a shortcoming to make up for. I had a sense that when I stood before God on the last day, I wouldn't have anything particularly hopeful to say in my own defense in regard to the things that I was ashamed, embarrassed about. I had a sense that I was accountable to God for my behavior, and there were some things going on in my mind and some things going on in my life that I just couldn't justify. I understood, but this was part of my confusion, that all that I'd done that was offensive to God would be weighed in a balance against all that I had done that was pleasing to God. And my eternal destiny would be determined by which side was weightier. I wasn't very confident that my good would outweigh my bad, but I was hopeful, and my hope was based on two things. One, as bad as I was in regard to some of the things I was doing and saying, I wasn't nearly as bad as some people I knew. And I thought if there's any kind of marking on the curve, if there's any kind of bell curve going on in Judgment Day, I would probably be okay. But that was actually part of my second hope. I had had the experience growing up that many times when I thought I was in serious trouble, I got off the hook. There were Decembers when I fought a lot with my sister and wasn't a particularly good boy, but Santa Claus still gave me what I hoped for. I got past that examination somehow. And there were examinations in school that I thought I failed and I somehow passed. There were whole years that I thought I was going to fail, and I always moved on to the next year. So I had this sense that probably the test wasn't going to be as hard as I worried about, and maybe I would do just fine. But I was in this confusion. And then this really smart man began explaining that the Bible was more plainly true than we thought. So I started reading the Bible for myself. I got into a nighttime Bible reading habit. And one night, I remember pretty clearly, it was November, way back in 1971. I was 16 years old. I read a couple of statements that the Apostle Paul made in the part of the New Testament called Romans. He says, "We shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, and each one of us will give account of himself to God." And I had developed the habit of saying, if this really smart guy is right, and the Bible should be taken plainly, then what does this particular passage mean to me? So I applied that question to those two statements. "I will stand before the judgment seat of Christ," he says, "and I will give account of myself to God." And that was the moment that the confusion cleared. And for the first time in my life, I really got it. Happily, the same thing happened to my father sometime about the same time. I got it. I realized that the death that Jesus died on the cross was to deal with the bad in my life in a way that the good never could. That I couldn't possibly do enough good to somehow blot out the bad, but the bad had to be given account of. I would give account for everything I had done that was displeasing to God. It's at that point that I got the idea that Jesus died on the cross to forgive sinners. So I prayed in a way I'd never prayed before. And I didn't pray about being a Christian or being worthy of being a Christian or being a better Christian. I just prayed about my sins and my need to be actually forgiven of them by what Jesus did on the cross. And I had this wonderful experience, whatever we can make of experiences, I had this wonderful experience of my prayer being heard and my sins being forgiven and a relationship with God just kind of taking a huge step forward. It was 6 months later, I was hanging out with some people my age who called themselves born-again Christians, and they asked me if I was a born-again Christian, and I had to get them to explain what in the world they meant. And when they explained what they meant, I was able to say, well, yes, I am, because that's exactly what I experienced 6 months ago. And a few weeks after that, a group of Christian men from a university group who were just coming to Kingston to get a ministry started at Queen's University, came and offered us a number of helpful seminars and workshops on how to grow as followers of Christ. And one night they drew us a diagram that we could use to explain to people how Jesus could overcome the great barrier between us and God. It was called the bridge illustration. And it pictured the cross of Christ as the bridge between the bridge over the chasm between man and God. And I realized that Jesus had been a bridge to me. Jesus had been the one who had brought me into a relationship with God by forgiving my sins and granting me, bit by bit, the power to live a life that pleases him. So all these years later, we got ourselves a bridge, and I count it a great privilege to be able to say that I have found Jesus to be true to his word, and the hope that he gives, and the help that he offers, and the purpose in life that he gives to all those who follow him is a treasure, is something worth living for, something worth living to discover. So we have this bridge, and it's just a symbol. But it's a symbol that has, I think, helped us to picture what Jesus is able to do. Last week we had a number of people walk across that bridge to symbolize the fact that they were seeing Jesus to be their way to God, and they were glad to go on record as trusting him to overcome that which kept them out of relationship with God and to be the source of their relationship. And in just a moment's time, the musicians are going to come forward and they're going to sing a song to the effect that today is the day. And while they're singing it, if you would find it meaningful, I would warmly welcome you to join what others have done and find your way up behind the instruments to these stairs. And if you would like to walk across the bridge to say to go on record as saying, yes, I too am a person who looks to Jesus as the bridge. Whether you have been living that way up until now for some time and would just like to declare it, we give you that opportunity, or whether in actual fact you have never entrusted yourself to Christ or publicly declared yourself to be one who's done so, and you would find it a meaningful way to say that to the assembly today. I'll give you that opportunity. So the musicians will come forward now, and in a few seconds' time, they will begin to sing the song, which I hope will be a help to you and an encouragement to you. And again, if you would like to be one who walks the bridge to say that you're looking to Jesus as the bridge to life, we would love to give you that experience. And once they start singing, you can find your way behind them up here to the stairs and just walk across the bridge to say that Jesus is the bridge to life for you.